Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield, and tonight once more we have another guest author joining us in the centre circle. But as per usual on such an occasion, I am joined by my two best and most treasured podcasting friends. First of all, Mr. Stephen Scragg. Stephen, how are we?
Oh, very well, Stu. Very well tonight.
Yeah,
how are we doing your end?
Yeah, good. Looking forward to this one.
I'm looking forward to this one. Ready to roll.
Excellent. Okay. We're going to get into, sort of a bit more detail about the book, but I think it's worth noting that for people whose knowledge stretches maybe as far as Barcelona and Real Madrid, and that's about as far as the knowledge goes, this should be a bit of a revelation for them, I think.
Oh, it'll be great, this one. There's so much more to Spanish football than just Barcelona and Real Madrid. As great clubs as they are and storied and such a fantastic, iconic rivalry. If you don't look at Spanish football beyond those two, then you miss so much. And Seville as a city offers a huge chunk of that.
It's a great point. Spanish football has so much to offer beyond the big two, and you sort of, a lot can be missed if people don't take the time to really look at Spanish football as a whole, as opposed to just the glamorous.
What you've got to do with Spanish football as well is take the historical context of the country into effect. These cluster of autonomous regions, all of which are very, very different in the way that they their outlook sometimes to life in general and how they view each other. It's Brexit a million times over in certain respects, but within that, within each autonomous region, there is a beating heart for football. And the intriguing thing about Spanish football is that there's only so many teams that have been champions of Spain. There's only been, I think it's nine. And there's only, I think, two cities that can boast multiple champions. And Barcelona isn't one of those, but the city we're talking about tonight is one of those.
What a brilliant piece of knowledge that is. I can see why we get you on. That's brilliant. Gary, with regards the history, you've run the wonderful political podcast series. And I know from our time together, I've learnt an awful lot about social Spanish history and a little bit about the Spanish Civil War, and I know that this is right in your sweet spot of discussion and topic tonight.
Definitely is, mate, and obviously living over in Spain, it's a topic close to my heart. El Gran Derby, as it's called, the Seville Derby, it's almost like a special derby because you get the aside from Real Madrid and Atletico, the other derbies, Espanyol and Barcelona and Valencia, Levante, and those sort of things, they're not derbies as such because the rivalry isn't a close rivalry between perceived equals. But in Andalusia, you get down to Sevilla, and other than Malaga, Huelva, and Granada, there's no club around the Seville. But it's like an isolated pocket, and that intensifies the rivalry between Sevilla and Betis. And the title of the book we're discussing tonight really captures that heat, that passion. The frying pan of Spain. It captures it wonderfully.
So I think it's safe to say you're looking forward to this one.
A little bit, mate. Just a little bit.
Brilliant. Well, obviously, my two best friends have been introduced, and now time to introduce the guest. Tonight, is a guy, football journalist, who's combined covering the beautiful game in his native Northern Ireland, which as soon as he opens his mouth, you'll be able to tell that, with that of his adopted home in Seville. The editor of Football España, his new book, which, you know, Gary mentioned, and why we're chatting about this tonight, The Frying Pan of Spain, Sevilla versus Real Betis, Spain's hottest football rivalry. And it details the intense football rivalry, like we said, in Seville. And like we've mentioned at the beginning, it's about why Spanish football is more than just Barcelona and Madrid. And who we have to thank for that, and who we have to thank for bringing this to our attention tonight, is Mr. Colin Miller. Colin, welcome, and thank you for joining us.
Oh, no, thanks so much for having me on. It's a pleasure.
It's like I say, Gary, just chomping at the bit for this one. And obviously, Stephen's knowledge is excellent. I think, you know, all of us have been sort of really looking forward to this one. And I think to get away from this constant in-your-face 24-hour news about Real Madrid and Barcelona, I'm going to say we're going to do a service to the populace here by taking a break from the big two and discussing not so much lesser known football insides, but I think we're going to bring a little bit of awareness and knowledge to maybe some of the fans who didn't quite realise, or someone who are not quite so aware of Spanish football.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, ultimately, the aim of this book was to showcase that Spanish football was much more than just the Real Madrid and Barcelona. And obviously, when you think of those two clubs, you think it's probably the biggest sort of matchup in world football. That they're certainly two of the three biggest clubs in terms of their brands and the levels of income that they will generate. But Spanish football has so many more layers to that, and you guys already alluded to it there. In the sense that in the match between Madrid and Barcelona, you know, it's filled with tourists, you know, and the ticket prices have become so extortionate and eye-watering. And look, it's not especially the fault of the clubs. I mean, that's just the nature of the game and of the sort of elite football clubs that you have nowadays. And the atmosphere is, as you know, they subsequently get a bit watered down, and that's really what drove me to Seville in the first place. You know, I mean, this is a city, and Andalusia is a region which is incredibly passionate. You know, these are people who are very outgoing, they're very flamboyant, and that's kind of conveyed in their support of their football clubs. And you know, when you get to a match day at either of these two clubs, and especially for Derby itself, it's something that's very special. You know, this is different, and look, these are two clubs who have huge, massive fan bases, and the match day experience it's very authentic. You know, there's strong identities here, and I keep repeating this, but I mean, like, when you think of Seville as a city, it really isn't the biggest. It's only got about a population of about 700,000, which is about a fifth of Madrid's. Yet it's got about 100,000 season ticket holders or socios that between the two clubs. I mean, that's sort of a level of passion and commitment that I don't really think you get anywhere else. And it's just a sense of this derby has so many layers to it that no other city really has, in the sense that, you know, this is genuinely a city where it's 50-50 split between Betis and Sevilla fans, and this goes right down family lines. You know, it's be quite rare that you would come across a Sevillano who has a family that are completely Sevilla fans or completely Betis fans. You know, it's something that divides families, and I don't really think you get that anywhere else, and especially the fact that I think this derby and the nature of it, in the sense that the two clubs are so combative and the two clubs are so significant, that the fact that they share the same city, that they're only 2 miles away from each other, it leads to the passion and the intensity going up a notch even further. So I think that was the entire idea behind this, was because you speak to a lot of British-based fans especially, and they might not even be aware that the Real Betis are from the city of Seville, you know, and people will either not be aware of this derby, or they'll completely underappreciate it. So that's what I was trying to get across. I mean, Seville is an incredible city, as anybody who will have visited it as a tourist will know and appreciate. But you know, it's got so much more to it than that, and the football really sort of is present throughout throughout the city and it's present throughout life for the people there. So, yeah, I mean, special city, special clubs and a special derby, and hopefully this book has done all that justice.
I mean, I'm going to come to the two guys in a second, but, you know, obviously we're going to dive into the book, and we're going to pick out some topics and, you know, and that sort of thing. And it's interesting, you know, you talk about this detail, and obviously, you know, when we're, as I say, we're always really lucky to, you know, to receive copies of books and to have a look and, you know, and to have a read through them. And at first glance, it looks like, and it is an epic journey and an epic account. You know, you open it and there's 31 chapters in this book, and, you know, people might think, oh, 31 chapters, that's, but each one is, I think the longest is 13 pages, so... You know, the way it's been written by you is very much almost snapshots, but to give a more well-rounded flavour of the clubs and of the city as well. And like I say, we'll come back to that and why you've done that. But, you know, like you say, it's just about getting across, as you've just said there, that there's so much to discuss, you know, between the two teams and the city. But Gary, coming to you first, you're an expat living in Spain. Your perceptions of Seville and football within Seville?
As I sort of alluded to earlier, I think the derby in Seville is almost unique. It can't be almost unique. It's either unique or it's not, a by mistake. But it is unique because the rivalry between Barcelona and Espanyol or Valencia, Levante, and even to some extent Real Madrid and Atletico, is different because the rivalry is almost one of equals. And so there's that sort of level playing field between the two clubs. But also, I think it's a geographical thing as well, because Andalusia is so far south from the main football body of Spain. It's together, but separate and apart and united, but different and the same. It's a sort of a real mix and match situation between the two clubs, that there's a rivalry, but also there's also almost a unity between them, because they are so separate and so distant from the rest of. But I would say Granada are in the Primera División at the moment, and you know Huelva and Malaga have been there in the past. But those are the two main clubs from the south of Spain. And they define the south of Spain in relation to La Liga. And I think that that defines the situation between the two clubs, because they're together and separate. They're united and apart. They are... It's a mix and match thing. It's like the frying pan. It's a fantastic way of describing the Sevilla derby.
Stephen, I mean, you know, as a well-known and passionate Liverpool fan, the concept of the derby, you know, and you will know it as well, obviously, in Liverpool, but the concept of the derby always, I assume, I can never ratify this. I always have to ask other people's opinions. But if you live within a city where a derby and an intense and relatively equal derby exists, it must bring a new dimension to the residents of that city, but also the supporters of those two teams.
Oh, it does. I mean, it's been lopsided for a good decade and a half now or so, but at a time when both Liverpool and Everton were punching at a reasonably level weight, mid-1980s in particular, in my lifetime, it was electric. I mean, it still is huge now. You know, there's nothing quite like going to Goodison Park and watching Liverpool win. You know, no matter what the Liverpool-Manchester United rivalry, you know, has to say for itself. You know, and I think pretty much any Liverpool fan from Liverpool, at the very least, would turn around and say the greatest feeling away from winning a trophy is winning your derby match away from home. And they are. They're just very, very different matches, because so much, you know, what the 3 points are worth or the next place in the round of the cup just goes out the window, because it's basically, it's not even a case of bragging rights, it's a case of being able to, you know, to have a deep sigh of relief that you've not lost to your neighbours, and it's not going to, because there's nothing quite like that pain of losing to your neighbours. And being in a big city where two clubs are up there and, you know, fighting for trophies or or just one-upmanship. You know, it is quite a stunning thing. I mean, I'll look across other cities and think, you miss out on so much by not having that rival there. You know, there's been times when Everton have been in the depths of despair and close to relegation on a couple of times in the 1990s. And no matter what, you know, that rivalry has to say for itself, I never wanted to lose Everton. You know, I didn't want them to go down because, you know, something would be lost to football in Liverpool.
It is, I mean, like I say, as we all know as well, you know, I live in Hull, and there's no real rivalry there apart from between the club and its fans. But, you know, Colin, it's true. You know, Colin, I mean, like I said, just before I spoke to the guys, you know, this book is epic in terms of its scope, but it's not epic in terms of how much a volume of reading. You know, it's so succinct and so clear and so to the point. Was it always an intention of yours to, you know, to take the reader right through the history of this, or was it just as you were progressing it, you felt that each part was relevant to the next part, and so it was best to just tell the whole story?
Well, it was a bit of a mixture of both. I think my main intention when I started writing the book was that this is that for myself. I first moved out to Spain to live 5 years ago, and in terms of Spanish football, I was always a football fan, but Spanish football until that point had never properly registered with me in the sense that I would you know, I didn't think I would later go on to work within the confines of it, but. So whenever I moved out there, and I knew in my head, you know, we've talked about the Madrid and Barcelona thing, but beyond that, there's such a sparsity of coverage that really outside of Spain, it's sort of distorted in the fact that people don't really register the other clubs as being significant at all. And so I wanted to put this book in layman's terms in that sense, because I had a reasonably fresh pair of eyes when I first visited Seville, when I first started to read about the clubs and about the rivalry and their history. And the more I read, the more I became fascinated and the more immersed I got myself into it. So it was that sense that I wanted to convey that to the reader, because I'm aware that most of the readers of this book will be coming at this. They might have knowledge of Spanish football. You know, you're probably going to have a degree of interest, of course. But in terms of the clubs and the rivalry, there's probably your knowledge will not be particularly deep at all. And there's going to be so many aspects that are when you go to live in Seville and you're going to these matches and you're working with the clubs, that you realise that are hugely significant to the people that live there. But haven't really been documented at all, certainly not in English. And obviously this is Derby, and these are clubs that not just haven't got proper coverage in English, but in Spanish, beyond the city of Seville itself, and beyond, say, club historians who have a vested interest in one club or the other. There's not really been a take on this which is from a so-called neutral perspective. You know, the people that have covered the clubs or who have discussed the clubs have done so very much through red or green-tinted glasses. And that's something that I kind of wanted to convey as well. The fact that it's the rivalry, and it's the sort of the fresh pair of eyes saying that it's the main story and the main theme throughout this book is that these are two clubs who are constantly competing for the same objectives, and obviously those have shifted over the years. But I wanted to put this into terms that, you know, that I've spoken about the passion and the intensity that's within the city of Seville, and maybe if you haven't lived there and you haven't been a regular at either of the club's games, you will never be able to properly grasp that. So those are sort of emotions that, in a way, can be a very good thing, but they've also been, you know, the level of sort of fanaticism, as it were, has also held both clubs back at different points in their history. So I've tried to convey all that and put it all in there, and behind all this behind the entire derby, and behind the sense of fandom that's really present throughout Spain, but particularly so in Seville, is the sense that the sort of the history and the socioeconomics of Spain are very important in terms of how these clubs have become who they are. And we're going to discuss this further, but there's contention run throughout this derby, right back to the foundation dates of the clubs, to which club had more influence with the authorities over the years. And quite a lot of that is obviously linked into the fact that Spain, for a large part of both of these clubs' history, Spain was a dictatorship, and, you know, politics and individuals who had certain levels of degree and certain degrees of wealth and power had so much influence and could potentially benefit so many clubs, and that's been so significant throughout Spanish football. So there's a lot of issues which are very contentious, which might not, for a British set of eyes, might not be particularly relevant, but for Spanish people and for Spanish fans, it is. So you have to, what I tried to do was to convey all this and break it all down into digestible terms, because essentially the city itself is important, Andalusia is important, in the sense that both sets of fans see themselves as maybe hard done by over the years because of the fact The general sense is that clubs from Madrid have received favourable treatment. Now, whether that's true or not is up for debate, but that's certainly the lens in which these people view themselves and view the clubs. And the sort of the change in dynamics of Spanish football are very important too. So I've tried to include all this. Obviously, the history is significant, politics is significant, the culture is significant. So I've tried to put all that in whilst making it, for a football fan, digestible and easily manageable.
Just listening to there, you can see why it took so many chapters to cover. Just one question though, while you were chatting then, I'm not saying how has the book been received in Spain, but certainly obviously within Seville, you know, you mentioned that, you know, the coverage and the you know, of the teams and, you know, the way they're written about is very much, you know, prejudice toward, depending on who the writer is. How has the book been received from, wouldn't say you're an outsider, but obviously from a neutral perspective, have they viewed it as a fair assessment? Were they, you know, are they happy with it, or has there been no real comment or feedback?
Yeah, the main sense definitely initially was that, you know, it was kind of like, why has there been this guy from Northern Ireland who's decided to come over to Seville and to cover this derby? And I mean,
that's kind of what I was thinking.
Yeah, and it's obviously that's a reasonable first assumption, but it's the sense that, you know, again, like, and we're obviously all massive fans of football, and a lot of what has been, and obviously these Football Times cover this perfectly, but a lot of what has been lost in football and kind of in recent years is this sort of sense of authenticity, especially at the sort of elite level. And I keep going back to this, but it's very important because Sevilla and Real Betis are both huge social institutions within the city of Seville, within the wider context of Andalusia and Spain. And that's something that it easily gets lost sort of outside those boundaries. So whenever you're coming into Seville, and Seville's, as I said, it's a wonderful city in so many aspects, but football is so significant there. And from a sort of, from almost an innocent point of view, you know, I'm just sort of coming in initially as a tourist, and you're just trying to sort of, you want to learn a little bit more about the clubs. And then you start to think, well, actually, nothing's ever really been done about this. So, you know, as I said, this book was literally years in the making. I mean, I had the idea in my head about three and a half years before I actually started to sit down and write it. And obviously there were so many fantastic books have come out over that period of time about other Spanish football clubs, and obviously sports writing in general is really taken off incredibly over the past number of years. And my fear was that somebody was going to take this topic, you know, because these are two huge clubs, a completely unique derby in this wonderful, incredible part of Spain, and nobody has gone near it. And I could never understand that. So there was always that sense throughout the years past that, you know, because I always thought, like, I'm not ready to write this book. You know, I hadn't lived there long enough. I hadn't spoken to enough people, and eventually this idea was going to go. So yeah, I mean, in terms of me, I think I immersed myself in it to such a degree that I just thought, how could this not have been done? So yeah, I mean, for me, it was a massive honour to be able to write this. And the fact that whenever I went over to Seville in September to do the little launch, I mean, it was the incredible reception, especially from the Spanish media. You know, there's a number of radio stations, and all the local media were on to it. And it was, I think it's the sense that they in the city itself, they think, you know, that there's almost a little bit of a sense that they know that they're different. They know that Sevilla, you know, kids run about in Sevilla and Real Betis tops. In any other city in Spain, that's not really the case. You know, people have, it's a different sense of fandom in Spain than it is elsewhere. People will support, 90% of people will support maybe Barcelona or Madrid, maybe Atletico, and then they'll sort of support their local team as a sort of secondary aspect of that, you know. And that's not really something that, again, I'm hopping back to British football fans, but I think in most other countries that isn't strictly speaking the case. And And that's a sense that it's a little bit different in Seville, that these two clubs have remained so prominent and have kept so true to their fans, and that these are clubs that are different. And it's just the sense of the rivalry was just, you know, I was researching the book, and Andy Brassel, who's obviously a very well-known European football writer, and he actually described this very well. He's covered the Seville derby a lot of times, and he said that for a British football fan's point of view, the best way of looking at the Seville derby is if you think of Newcastle and you think of Sunderland, and you put those fans in the one city. And it's just that. I mean, you've got two extremely passionate and loyal supporter bases that almost, to an outsider's point of view, it doesn't make any sense that why these clubs were so big. I mean, maybe, okay, you look at Sevilla's Europa League title in the past 15 years, but before that, these are two clubs that essentially won one league title each, one Copa del Rey title each. You know, two clubs that didn't really have any footing in success, yet had kept these huge supporter bases. So we'll try to explain just why that was the case. And again, you have to look at what defines a Spanish football fan. You know, these fans aren't just, they're not just turning up for 90 minutes of a match every Saturday or Sunday, whenever it happens to be. They encompass the feelings of being a Sevillista or a Betico. Like, that is who they are. You know, they take up every aspect of how they approach their lives, almost, you know. And they there's tens of thousands of fans can be attending open training sessions, and it's that level of fanaticism that it's almost it's endearing in a way. And I think it's almost, when you look at last year's Copa Libertadores final between River Plate and Boca Juniors, in the sense that, you know, the fanaticism in Argentinian football and South American football is just almost off the scale. And yet that's almost like it's taken that a little bit too far, in the sense that, you know, the fact that that final had to be relocated to Madrid showed that, you know, it was almost the player's safety and fan safety wasn't guaranteed at those matches. So Seville kind of has all, for me anyway, I always thought that the Seville derby had all of the positive aspects of that fanaticism without actually pushing it out to being openly dangerous. And I think a lot of people maybe have that misconception of Seville derbies, if you're going as a fan, that it's going to be, you know, you're not going to be able to mix in or whatever else. But that isn't strictly speaking the case. I think the fanaticism is generally a very positive thing, and hopefully I've been able to reflect that in the book as well.
It is. I mean, you know, Gary, listening to Colin, you know, speaking there, and, you know, you can hear the passion for the city, for the clubs. But, you know, in your opinion, well, two things, Gary. One, you know, what Colin has tried to get out of the book, he absolutely has, or certainly in my opinion, he absolutely has done. But also, you know, sometimes when you have this, you know, this intense rivalry and this, you know, the political inference, certainly within Spain, sometimes the story is best told through the eyes of a neutral, isn't it, rather than somebody who is skewed one way or the other.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and as you mentioned, Colin captured that difference between the two sides in the city. You know, it's not a matter of, you know, what job you do. It's, when somebody asks the question, what are you? Are you red? Are you green? There's a dichotomy between the two. There's no sort of, I'm an accountant or I'm a bird watcher or whatever. You're red or you're green. And the definition of the people in Seville is very much associated to the football clubs. And there's the socio-economic difference as well between the areas, the geographic areas where the clubs are based, and I hope we're going to touch on it with Colin later, with the area of Betis, which particularly defines the fans of that club as opposed to the fans of Sevilla.
I mean, you know, Stephen, you know, we talk about this quite a lot, you know, and it's, I'm not sure if reassuring is the right word, but it's, I think there's probably a comfort that certainly I can take, you know, listening to Colin, reading the book, you know, that football, no matter where it's played, is always under the self-same influence. There are things that you know, Colin's mentioning, there's more passion, there's more, you know, the division is more equal, shall we say, if that's a saying. But it's still reassuring to know that wherever the game is played, it's always under the same influences. You know, it's always about, politics are always involved. There's always a social element to it. There's always a cultural element to it. For me, I find it really reassuring.
Yeah, it's always the same variables. It's always the same passion. You know, it stirs the same senses. you know, with the round ball and the pitch and nets at either end. And it means everything to be able to put the ball in the net at one end more than the other team does at your end. And that's just the great thing about football, is that it just sweeps through all kind of like differences in culture and nations and parts of the world, is that it's just something that's there and familiar. And as you say, it's a comforting thing. And to see that familiarity and things that strike a chord with you in a completely different part of the world, a different city, you know, people will be speaking different language, but there is something totally familiar and evocative, and you can just completely understand it.
It like I say, for me, it's a very reassuring element. Colin, so, you know, we can chat about the subject all day, which is great, but I suppose really, you know, for people who are listening, you know, who may be obviously not quite as well versed as, you know, as the three of you guys are, just if you can, just briefly, the sort of the early development of both clubs and, you know, and football within that region that has sort of set this template in place.
Yeah, of course. I mean, the sort of stories and the dates that are involved with the foundations of both clubs are very highly contentious, and they do in many ways set the tone for this entire rivalry, which in many ways it's all a lot of sort of conspiracy theories, many of which are completely half-assed. So I've tried to sort of dissect that a little bit. But listen, I think we need to first of all talk about Seville as a city. It played host to the first ever documented football match in Spain, and again, that's almost an issue that keeps continually being updated with the sort of coming to light of new evidence, as it were. But in March 1890, Sevilla FC played the club that later turned into the Recreativo de Huelva. Now, these two clubs had very strong Scottish roots, and this is largely because there's many British companies who were sort of setting up camp in the south of Spain around them. There's a lot of mining companies around the sort of southern Andalusian coast, and then in Seville had a lot of huge British businesses that were starting to come into it and everything else. So these Sevilla essentially were set up as a club of essentially business people who'd come in from Britain, and the Sevilla were formed on Burns Night. So there's a big Scottish influence that goes right through their history. Now, the contention sort of lies in the fact that match only came to light in an article that was written in the Dundee Courier. It was published in 1890, but it was only unearthed in 2012. So up until 2012, everybody assumed that Sevilla had been formed as a club in 1905, which is when they registered their articles of association with the civil government. So Sevilla then, their members voted to ratify the change from 1905 to 1890, which makes them the second oldest football club in Spain behind Recreativo de Huelva. But it makes them the oldest football club that was solely associated with football, whereas the recreation club in Huelva did all sorts of sports, all variety of sports. Now, again, as a sort of British football fan, this is something I say, well, why is this so significant? But sort of the foundation dates and the history, are these all form part of the identity of a club and of their status, as it were. And Recreativo take a huge source of pride in being the oldest club. You know, they're El Decano, you know, they're the dean of Spanish football. And again, the fact that Sevilla sort of rearranged their foundation date based on this one newspaper article, whilst you could say, yes, there's the evidence that this club reformed, there's some people saying, well, actually, this isn't strictly speaking the case, and they're moving this club forward. Whereas then the likes of Athletic Club, the Bilbao and FC Barcelona are no longer the second and third oldest clubs in Spanish football. So for Sevilla's foundation, that was hugely contentious. But equally across the city of Betis, there's this different level of contention. Now, the club's full title is Real Betis Balompié. Now, they were an amalgamation of Sevilla Balompié and another club at the time named Betis FC. They eventually merged in December 1914. But initially, the club dates back to 1907. Sevilla Balompié were formed by students, and they all their families had a military background. So essentially, Sevilla Balompié were set up to sort of represent Seville, to represent Andalusia. There was not I think it's a little bit unfair to say there was a nationalistic outlook to this, because Sevilla FC, obviously the first club of the city, had very strong links to sort of businesses and to sort of expatriates who'd come into the club, come into the city and set up this club. Whereas these guys who set up Sevilla Balloon PA were essentially, you know, we want to set up a team that represents not so much, well, you know, workers and people who maybe identify themselves as being a Spanish club. And that's why they use Balloon PA, which is essentially the direct Spanish translation of football. And obviously a lot of clubs throughout Spain use footballs in the FUTBOL, which is, you know, the Hispanicized version of it. But Lumpia is a direct translation. So all this was significant in the sense that this club wanted to be different. They wanted to represent a certain type of person within the city. And the contention actually surrounds the foundation of Betis FC. And again, it's not so much the date, but it's the context of how this was set up. Now, Betis is a word that's derived from the Roman name of the city. And essentially, the individuals involved with setting up Betis FC, this either happened in 1909 or 1910, but that's not really significant. What it was significant was the fact that the sort of the tale goes, and this is a huge, huge bone of contention within the city, is that there had been a split within Sevilla FC, who had apparently refused to sign a working class player from the city, and this had led to a split within the board of directors, and that subsequently led to the foundation of Betis. Now, whether or not that's true is contentious, to say the least. And there's a lot of other evidence, which, again, isn't totally reliable and it's not completely infallible, but it suggests that the actual split hadn't come from Sevilla FC, but had come from Sevilla Balloon PA, who, of course, later then formed with Betis FC. So, again, this is something where it's quite complicated to follow, maybe from me just saying this all, but this is huge, because this essentially is like, well, the split that formed Betis wasn't the fact that, you know, this wasn't like a solely class-based decision. And there's so many, just like everything within this derby, there's so many variables and there's so much nuance within each aspect of it, because it's very easy to, for a football fan, especially if you're coming in from outside the city, be like, oh, this team were associated with a working class and this team were associated to be more maybe a middle class or a señorito culture. Now, I don't think that's really significant. I think that at times that had been the case within the first 20 or 30 years within the city, but certainly within the past 50 or 60 years, that hasn't really been significant at all. And I think there's very lazy assumptions to be made between this. And again, with the political situation in Spain, it was always, there's always this sense of, you know, the Francoism that evolved from this nationalistic outlook. And you could look at it and say, well, actually, Betis were the club that were formed with this nationalistic outlook. But that, when you look at the characters that were involved within the first 10 or 20 years of the club, they didn't reflect that at all, you know. And there's so much nuance again that there's no firm conclusions to be drawn from this. But it's very interesting to see just how the sort of story or the narrative around this has evolved to the point where it's laid down not the hatred as such between the clubs, but certainly there's a lot of animosity there that comes from ideas or from stories that aren't necessarily true. So it really was fascinating from a sort of research perspective to kind of unearth all this and to be like, well, what exactly is the real truth behind this? And again, even on the Real Betis website of how their history and how they were founded, there's a lot of ambiguity used in the language. You say, well, this is based on hearsay, or this evidence is, you know, it's not entirely reliable because of the nature of when it was, and a lot of people were writing articles, and a lot of people were then spreading information with a vested interest. So yeah, it was interesting to debunk all this and to see, like, this is actually the foundation of the club, and this is what they initially were there to represent. But just how it evolved, I find it particularly fascinating, and I think it's very relevant in terms of how the clubs are today, to look at how they were founded and how significant this is for a lot of the fans.
It is. I mean, like I say, I mean, you know, obviously, you know, I've read the book, but listening to it, you know, it's absolutely fascinating. And for me, again, as a true outsider looking in, and Gary, you know, you've got a better perspective on this, you know, certainly than I do, living in Spain, and obviously your knowledge of Spanish history. But to me, Spanish football, and, you know, we've talked about it, you know, like I say, a lot on the political podcast, we've talked about it, you know, the geographical regions, even tonight. But I think, you know, Colin's used the word nuance, and to me, Spanish football, certainly, you know, early Spanish football, it was the, you know, the minute nuances that created these lasting huge legacies. But it seems to be just the almost the small things that have grown and grown to create what we have now.
Well, yeah, that's true. And obviously moving things forward to the end of the dictatorship of Primo de Rivera and the Republic, the Spanish Republic. Betis, as a working class club, sort of prospered. And after the Civil War, because the Andalusia was particularly prey to Franco bringing the army of Africa across from the North African coast into Andalusia, and Kiko Delano, who took over Andalusia pretty much as his own fiefdom. And because Sevilla was perceived as being the traditional club, and Betis were being the working class club, there was always this massive thing where there was a political overtones that dominated football. I wonder if it particularly asked the Collins' thoughts on that sort of area.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. It's a sense that. In terms of the clubs, and especially in those early years, when you look at it as well, the sense that Spanish football, and it's very important to underline this, is that it was all regionalised at the time. There wasn't a national league competition until 1929. So the fact is that for the first sort of 20 or 30 years of the club's existence, they were all playing regionalised cups and regionalised tournaments. So it was very hard to sort of pinpoint just where the clubs were. In a sort of wider Spanish context. And I know we're going to go on to discuss this further, but the Civil War really changed everything for Spanish football, but again, especially in Seville, because it came just over a year after Betis had won the league title. And it was the only league title they would ever win. And it came at a time when Betis had just agreed this massive land deal with the local government. And the outbreak of the Civil War essentially meant that had gone to shreds. So the Civil War ruined Betis almost as a club. They almost went out of existence. And again, there were certain clubs were hit particularly hard, and certain clubs ended up prospering out of the sort of chaos of everything. And this is again a strand that runs right through the rivalry today, where if you look at a lot of the sort of social media or the online debates between fans of each club, there's a lot of sort of to-ing and fro-ing between just how significant this was, between how the characters that were leading the clubs, where did their political allegiance lie, and is it true to say that a certain individual had a sort of a liberal tendencies, or if he did, why was it that club prospered so much during the Francoist era? And it was just said there about how Andalusia was and Seville was the first area essentially to fall to the nationalist Francoist forces. And I mean, it's completely fair to say that, you know, there was so much resistance within the city, but the fact is that Seville was seen at the time as a sort of the military centre of that movement, and it was very hard for the city not to fall in that. That meant that those two clubs in that area of Spain immediately became cut off from the rest. And whenever there was during the Civil War, there was clubs and parts of Spain still tried to hold national tournaments, but it became so restricted. But Andalusia had become completely cut off, and it was almost a different environment. So all that is very important in the sort of the decades that followed, and how the clubs sort of emerged out of that. Because again, the fact was that this came at such a critical point for both clubs, because Sevilla had won the Copa in 1935 and Betis had won the league, and then Civil War breaks out a year later, and everything that had happened in the 5 or 6 years leading up to that, and it had been so promising for both clubs, everything changed. And that was really the moment that it's Spanish football and the Spanish Civil War are so closely intertwined, not just at that contemporary time, and not just even in the decades that followed, but even now, those effects have been so profound that both clubs' identity has been shaped by it. And it's true as well for a lot of others throughout Spanish football. There's even a sense at the minute that Levante are trying to clear in the 1937 Copa del Rey title, it's under different FIFA regulations into what constitutes that club claiming that title, because it wasn't played out officially by the Spanish FA, because of the sense that the Spanish Civil War meant that the Spanish FA could not make that sort of decision because certain clubs weren't involved. But these are you know, this history and these successes or otherwise are so important and so significant in how these clubs are shaped and how they view themselves. And it's through that sort of lens that you need to look at everything. I think of the history pre-Civil War and the history post-Civil War have been warped, and they've also been distorted as well. I keep saying about the sort of half-truths that have been reported throughout the year. And those sort of been passed from one generation to the next, but it's also, I think, it's significant to just take a sort of step back and look at how everything's evolved, because as has been alluded to as well, each region of Spain is so different from the other, and the south of Spain, again, it's something that, you know, it's almost like a different country from everywhere else in the aspect of how they define themselves and look at themselves. So all this is significant into the modern day Seville derby as we know it.
Do you think, though, Colin, that it's probably true that Andalusia was probably more affected, well, certainly more quickly affected by the Spanish Civil War than any other region of Spain, and particularly Seville, because it was the major city of Andalusia?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And again, that's the case that both clubs were shaped by the immediate events of the Civil War. And again, how they both evolved afterwards, and even in the sense that both stadiums and both regions of the city where the clubs play were shaped by the Civil War. It's Sevilla's the Nervión district, which is a sort of swanky business district within central Seville, that immediately became the headquarters of the regime within the city. No, it wasn't the sense that the regime were Sevillistas or anything like that. It was just the sense that was how, because of the location of the club within the city, that's how it panned out. Whereas the Betis Stadium was bombed, and again, I've just mentioned the land deal they signed a year before all this happened. The Betis Stadium was bombed, and it was essentially Heliopolis during these years was almost a no-go area in terms of it was used for, allegedly used for a lot of, you know, political torturings and everything else. And that sense of Betis being ruined by this so quickly, and yeah. Sevilla almost prospering just from the sense that their location within the city and how the regime used that location. And again, immediately after Spanish football resumed in 1939, and the clubs had the option of abstaining for a year to sort of restructure themselves and to reorganise themselves. And Real Oviedo were a club who took that option because, and again, they were particularly hard hit. Betis didn't. They decided to go back into the league system straight away, but they were broke. You know, their membership had gone down from thousands of people to just double figures, and they immediately were relegated, and they didn't properly recover for decades. So again, all these decisions and all these moments were so crucial. At the time, they might not have seemed it, but when you're looking at it from a historical lens, it's completely shaped their future.
Yeah, having read this part of the book, it's a particular interest to me in my sort of course libre of the Spanish Civil War. Do you think that Sevilla, prosper's not the right word, but sort of suffered less than Betis did because of perceived political allegiances?
Yeah, no, I think it's undoubted that Sevilla prospered from the Civil War, and Betis suffered a lot. Now, that I don't think that's within dispute. I think what you would call into question is why did that happen? And again, I think the answer to that is a lot less clear than would be satisfactory, because I think that, okay, in the next two decades, they were absolutely decisive in shaping both clubs. But it's hard to describe this, but for Sevilla, their president was a guy called Ramon Sanchez Pizjuan, who their stadium's now named after. Now, it's undeniable that the club benefited during the Civil War and the aftermath of it. But you kind of think, well, why did they benefit? They obviously, I spoke about the location and the fact that their stadium sort of became this hub of importance and significance. But they also had a number of very significant links to key political figures within the city. They had a lot of wealthy backers who yielded a lot of influence and power. And again, it's natural that these guys, these wealthy businessmen, had seen the Republic as a threat to them and to their sort of status within society. So the fact is that the city, obviously, we've spoken about it, it fell very swiftly to the Francoist forces, but it was Sevilla and Atletico Madrid were the two clubs to benefit. And again, Sanchez Pizjuan, seen as this sort of liberal politician, but again, this is a guy who is the most influential figure in their entire history. And I think he had a political background of being liberal, but he manoeuvred himself, and very crucially, he manoeuvred the club in such a way that they undoubtedly thrived. And there's a lot of evidence to suggest that he was very comfortable in aligning himself and the club with a lot of high-ranking figures within the Francoist regime. But at the same time, this is a bit of a stretch from believing that he was an actual phalangist himself. So I think that before and after the national conflict, his skill essentially was acting diplomatically. He forged allegiances where he thought he would benefit and where he thought the club would benefit. He won a lot of support in high places. And I think it's too important to sort of recognise the context of contemporary Spain and, you know, adhering to the cause as such. I mean, it was very easy to do that at the time, you know, and if you just sort of look back on this and sort of with the benefit of 2020 hindsight, of course you kind of think, well, he was, that meant that he supported their ideas. I'm not sure, having read so much about it and having done so much research about it, I'm not sure that was the case at all. And I think that both clubs had so many people who thrived and suffered so greatly under the regime. I just don't think that you can put this down to that being decisive in itself. I think that the key difference was that Betis essentially had no succession planning. They had a lot of bad luck, and they just didn't have the economic or presidential nous that Sevilla did have over that period, and that just became so decisive.
Yeah, perhaps it's easier to quite swap a red shirt for a blue shirt than it is for a green shirt to a blue shirt.
Like I say, this is, you know, I knew, you know, when we started this that it would be, like I say, Gary's cause celebs. It's fascinating. Like I say, you know, we talk about school days, but listen to you both talk, and it, you know, and Steve, and I, you know, obviously you've listened as well. I'm not sure what you think, but it always seems, you know, like we say about 2020, you know, hindsight and 2020 vision, but it always seems really difficult to change perception. Football culture seems to stick easily, if you get my drift, Stephen. It's, you know, once something is insinuated or mentioned, it becomes very difficult to change. And as time goes on, it's almost this perpetuation of myth becomes really difficult to sway, if that makes sense.
That makes complete sense. You know, it's that concept of a, you know, what one city, and there's always got to be a kind of like a class divide. You know, there's always got to be kind of like one club is the upper class club, one club is the working class club. Or, you know, in this country, in the UK, it was often a case of, you know, one club is Protestant, one club is Catholic, even down to Liverpool and Everton. You know, it's argued over now, but, you know, it's lost with the mist of time over which club was meant to be which. So, but these, not stigmas, but labels were given to football clubs. And the intriguing thing about Spanish football, and the most intriguing thing about Spanish football, is those divisions are so pronounced from certain region to certain region. Is that it? Asking football to kind of like, you know, just slot in back to normal and click back into gear after the Civil War was akin to kind of like asking, you know, the vast majority of Europe to just kind of like get along after the Second World War, had there been kind of like a European Super League at the time, because these were people who were at war with each other, and suddenly you're picking up the football again after you know, putting the guns down. You cannot underestimate just how pivotal a time it was, and deep resentments that were fostered and then taken out onto the football pitch.
I mean, you know, it's a great point. Like you say, you know, you know, 1 minute it's arms, and then you're laying down arms, and you know, and you're playing a game together. But, you know, Colin, you know, like we say, the Civil War, you know, to me, in my ignorance, and I fully confess, although I do learn a lot when I'm on with Gary, but and I am trying to learn more and more. But it's, you know, to me, it cuts right through, you know, the development of Spain, certainly in the, you know, in the 20th century. But in terms of, you know, football in Andalusia and Betis and Sevilla, sort of post-Civil War to what we would call 80s, 90s, you know, modern day football, to me, you know, looking at reading the book, listening to you guys talk, you know, it seems that it set back the two clubs and the success of the clubs. You know, it took them a long time to recover.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, as we said, though, Betis suffered hugely. And I think, actually, Betis became so bad after the Civil War. They were relegated initially in 1940, the first year back. They returned, but they were relegated again in 43. And that started a run where they were 15 years away from the top flight. They actually spent seven successive seasons in the third tier. Now, that, ironically, is a large reason, if not the main reason, why the Betis fan base grew at such an incredible rate over the subsequent years. You know, this was a club who had been so recently the Spanish champions, yet now they were the underdog, and their fans became so accustomed to losing that their spirit became very hardened. It became almost unbreakable, and that was sort of the narrative that was brought up, was that Betis had transformed. Had they just have transformed into being this club who were kind of middling between the top two divisions before you ever really getting any sort of genuine success, but things never got particularly awful, they probably wouldn't have ever grown into the social institution which they did throughout the sort of post-Civil War period. You know, and this was a club who, unlike Sevilla, who were still playing in the top flight, half of their away matches, or sorry, all of their away matches, which obviously half their games, were played at the other end of Spain, so their fans never got to see them more than once every couple of weeks, whereas Betis were very much taking the game directly to all the little towns and pueblos surrounding Andalusia, because they were playing regionalised football. So their fans not only could go to almost all their matches, but all these little towns that had never seen a big club come and play football there, Betis all of a sudden were coming here once or twice every season for seven successive years. So they took the game directly to the people, and that allowed them to initially build this mass fan base. And it was over these years that the birth of their sort of this terminology that's applied to their fans of Mangi Pierda. You know, they always support their team even when they lose, and this idea that, you know, we might not have a champion team, but we've got a champion fan base, essentially, and that's why they see themselves as being a bit different, a bit left field than any other club, because no other club went through such turmoil over such a long period of time after just so recently having been champions. And again, that makes it very different to Sevilla, who over the sort of 1940s, they won another Copa title, they won the league title for the first time, and they grew into this genuine force. Initially, we had Atletico de Madrid, and you could sort of see that those were the two clubs who initially benefited from the sort of chaos that this political situation within the country had sort of laid down for them. And again, we talk about the fact that this is a club, that this is a city, sorry, this is very much 50-50 split between Betis and Sevilla. Yeah, I think Betis are a much bigger club outside of the city of Seville than Sevilla are, in the sense that they've got fans right across Andalusia. And the Andalusian diaspora across Spain happened in sort of 50s and 60s, when a lot of the local workers just left for places in Catalonia and the Basque country in search of better pay work. And that's why you have today Betis have more fan clubs in Catalonia than Espanyol do. I mean, that is absolutely insane, but it shows that Betis in a way were very fortunate, almost in the sense that they were so bad that it allowed them to grow at this particular time to such a mass sort of social force, not just within Seville or within Andalusia, but within Spain because of the migration patterns that happened. So it's actually that is a sort of development, the club development that I can't really think applies to any other big club within Europe, certainly, and that's something that makes it very different. Whereas Sevilla found success on the pitch, where Betis did not. Betis found success off it, and that is the sort of theme that again has just makes this rivalry, and just makes the nature of the city and of the derby particularly unique.
I mean, you know, Gary. You know, like I say, I know I keep going back to the Plural podcast, but you know, we often talk about how football clubs are such an enormous sense of pride within communities and within cities, and it's not just, you know, through the supporters, it's players who, homegrown players who represent even just a particular area within the city. But But reading this book and looking at some of the players and the quality of players who have played in this game and played in this derby, and obviously none come bigger than Maradona, who's played Sevilla. But it's incredible when you look at the names, and there's this association between Real Madrid and Barcelona, but you look at the names that have played within this fixture and the sense of pride that must have brought to the fans of two clubs.
Absolutely, Marty. And it just interesting to underscore what Colin said there, that in Catalonia there are more Betis fans than there are Espanyol fans. No, just take that for a moment there. Just consider that for a moment. That Catalonia is a long way from Andalusia, and that just gives an idea of the reach of the passion for Betis. But going back to the players you meant, you said we played in this derby. Just to give some names, Maradona, as you mentioned, Suker, Zamorano, Simeone, Prozinecki, Dani Alves, Sergio Ramos. I mean, these Rakitic. These are massive players who've become world stars, who sort of made their name playing for these two clubs in Seville, and it's a massive thing. And just throw one in there, Betis actually broke the world record for a transfer when they signed Denilson, the Brazilian wide player, who was often described as the lollipop man because he gets so many step overs that he almost follows his own feet sometimes, but. The Sevilla clubs have had some magnificent players playing for them in the Seville derby and obviously beyond.
It's funny there, Stephen, that that Gary's mentioned Danielson, because obviously for me that was the one when they when the world record transfer fee was broken and to Real Betis and obviously it's no disrespect to Real Betis, but it reminded me a little bit of the Gianluca Lentini signing at AC Milan. It was one of those, I didn't see that coming, or where's that come from, or how has that happened? But it, like I say, it shows you that there is so much more to Spanish football and the ambition of Spanish football than just the two big clubs.
Yeah, it was magnificently left field. I mean, what a splash to do, to put yourself into a wider context, to break the world record transfer fee and bring in this Brazilian international that, a huge amount of teams were interested in signing. But, it was. I mean, in the same way that Maradona's arrival at Sevilla after Napoli, it just focused the whole world's attention on the city of Seville. Even for a briefest moment, and it was within some of those moments that I acclimatized to the fact that Seville was a huge footballing city, and to open my eyes to the fact that there was so much more to Spanish football than met the eye. I mean, I'm old enough to remember the rise of the Basque clubs in the 1980s, so I was always of the mind that there was more to Spanish football than just simply Real Madrid and Barcelona, but it brought Andalusia into the picture as well for me in the fact that Betis were showing this fantastic amount of ambition to be able to go out for a player like Danielson, and that Sevilla were meaning business by bringing Maradona, who will bring so much attention to the club.
It brings attention wherever he goes.
Wherever he goes.
Literally. I'm interested. I mean, like I say, I am a true fan of football, and it's well documented. I actually support the team as much as I follow the trials and tribulations of Hull City. I don't live and breathe aside. But if you could just sort of put into perspective attending one of these Seville derby games. What is it? How is it characterised? Contemporary derby games now. What's the characterisation? What's the feeling or the vibe, if you want, of those games?
Yeah, I mean, again, like these derby matches are the most important days of the year within the city, almost. You know, especially up alongside the Feria. But these two games are huge, obviously. You know, and it's the fact that, like, I mentioned it earlier, but the fandom, it's not just the sort of 90 minutes or 2 hours surrounding the game. It's almost a whole weekend of intense coverage in the day itself. You know, the clubs tend to hold the open training session in the morning, where maybe 5,000 or 10,000 fans would attend, and that just sort of sets up the field for the entire day. And then whenever the teams are going off from their hotels to the stadiums, you know, they're surrounded by thousands of fans lighting off sort of firecrackers and flares and everything else. I keep going back to this sort of theme of, like, authenticity, and the fact that all these feelings and all this sort of atmosphere and the noise and the chanting and just even the sort of the smell of it, in the sense that, you know, this is very distinctive. It's the fact that this is like a party atmosphere almost, and the people are so involved in this. Like, it's so important to them, because, again, most of the people going to these matches, like, the overwhelming majority are people who live in the city, who probably have someone in their immediate family who's supporting the other team, and you know, if they were to lose this, it would be, you know, it's almost like going to be a couple of weeks of taunting and almost a hell for them. But if they win it, it's the complete reverse of that. So people are still involved in it, and it's just that's what you get whenever you have two clubs in this scale within the same city, within the same sort of boundaries. It's impossible to escape it, and you know, we've spoken about how defined the sort of fandom is. You have to be better or severe. Every time I do an interview, I'm asked, well, which club is it you really prefer? You know, just tell us, you know, like, we're gonna turn the microphones off, just tell us which it is. You know, we need to know. And it's this sense that you just have to be, you know, you just have to choose, and that underlines the entire sort of feeling around the derby. And it's so separated, yet everybody knows that, either, you know, you're sort of your partner or one of your children maybe, or one of your parents has supported the other team. And that's the fact that I actually think that makes the whole experience, I sort of tried to compare it with South America earlier, but I think that makes the whole experience actually better, the fact that underlying this entire fierce sort of rivalry between the two, there is definitely underlying respect and an underlying sense that a lot of the sort of, certainly contemporarily, the sort of issues that both clubs and both sets of fans face is actually very similar, you know, and that's something that I think, when all is said and done, it actually makes the experience as either a fan or a neutral when you're inside the ground, it makes it so much more enjoyable, because there's no sense that there's actually, unlike maybe at certain points within the history of the fixture, there's no real tangible sense that there's going to be an outbreak of violence here. You know, this has all the great things you expect from a fierce derby, but it doesn't have any of the nonsense or the sort of hooliganism that comes with it. Those incidents would be very, very isolated and really, really, it would be comparable to any other sort of city in that sense. So I think the experiences are very special. And the games themselves obviously are very special too. And I keep speaking about the passion that comes from being a fan of either of these clubs, and that's reflected pre-match, even when they belt out their hymnals, and they do it with such passion and such a sense that this is everything. Like, this is what everything has led up to. These couple of minutes before the match, where they let it all out, and they know it for 2 hours, it's going to be. It's going to be an intense cauldron, and that's exactly what it is. And I really would implore anybody who hasn't been to the Seville Derby to try and attend one. I think that the process, people assume that the process of getting tickets or getting access to the game is tougher than it is in reality. I think that if you do the appropriate planning, it really shouldn't be too difficult to do it. The games do sell out naturally, but I just think this is, like, I've been to a lot of different derbies and a lot of different clubs around Spanish football and European football, and this genuinely does stand out for me. It's just not comparable to any other game. It's your entire day, your entire weekend. There's so many different layers and elements to this that you're not going to get anywhere else, and it's certainly going to be worth every penny of your trip to do this, because outside of the actual game and the football itself, it's such an incredible city in so many different levels that there really is something for everyone. But it's the football that encapsulates all that passion, all that sort of sense that Seville and it's Sevilla and Real Betis. Seville is essentially the city that, when you think of Spain in your mind, it's what Seville is. You know, it's the heat, it's the weather, it's the sort of food, the sort of flamenco music, everything else. All the sort of things that you typify with Spain, all the positive things are what I've seen within Seville. So I think that's certainly something that I would try to say to anybody who's even doubting whether you should go or not, because even a match that isn't a derby, there's a level of atmosphere there that is right up there with the very best in football. But a derby it stands out, and you can't escape it in the city, and you certainly wouldn't want to.
So just jump in there, mate. I mean, I haven't been to a Seville derby, but I'm gonna, because I've been inspired by the book there. But the only sort of comparison I can draw between the Seville derby is the Basque derby between Sociedad and Athletic Club, because the Seville derby is almost like, it's okay, this is the family squabble. Spain isn't invited to watch, but you're not part of it. It's a thing it's a close relationship between these two clubs in this city that is far away from most of the other football clubs in Spain. And as I say, you're invited to watch, but you know, this is a little family squabble between these two cousins of players that dispute this between a family relationship. Is that right, Colin? Do you think that's fair?
Yeah, I think it absolutely is fair. And I think whenever people think of Spain and the regionalism that exists, everybody always thinks that their region or that their city is the best in Spain. There's a very, very sort of strong sense of local identity within that. And that's true across Spain. But I think whenever football fans look at the derbies and at the rivalries, most outsiders to Seville or Andalusia will look at the Seville derby and think, yeah, that is the best one. And I know you mentioned the Basque derby there, and again, two very significant clubs, obviously, but there's a lot of differences. Obviously, the fact they don't play in the same city is a crucial difference. And also the sense that because of the sort of politics and the socioeconomics and history of the Basque country, that Real Sociedad and Athletic Club have always sort of been very much fighting for the same things for their entire existence. They've always identified as, you know, we're Basque, we're both sort of fighting for the same ultimate objective. And even today, the derbies itself, they have an underlying sense of friendliness. You know, it's very, very common before those games that fans en masse will be mixing within the streets sort of surrounding the game. It's different in Seville in the sense that the away fans only get about 400 or 500 tickets, and they're given a police escort to the ground from their own stadium. So they do the 2.5 kilometer or 2.5 kilometer walk from one ground to the other, surrounded by police, and obviously they're not given a particularly friendly welcome at the home stadium. And that's something that doesn't really happen in any other derby, I think, just because of the sense that there's always one club that's in the ascendancy, and there's very, very distinct areas. This is different, and this has something that isn't evident anywhere else in Spanish football. And as you said as well, the fact that this is almost Seville is cut off from the rest of Spain, that's been something that's been a thing throughout the existence of the clubs. They've been cut off, they've been different. Yeah, obviously, you know, things have evolved and changed over the years. That still stands out, and this is a game that's incomparable.
It's incredible. We've spent the best part of it, you know, nearly an hour and a quarter already, and I think, you know, to bring it right up to, you know, to contemporary standards, Stephen, we've not even mentioned Sevilla's success in the Europa League or UEFA Cup, which by any margin of measure is, you know, the success they've had in that tournament is incredible. But such is obviously the topics for discussion, you know, we've it's not even warranted a mention within an hour and a quarter of chat.
Just shows you how much there is to talk about when it comes to football and Seville. But yeah, that Sevilla side that clocked up such a, you know, it was 5 in 6 seasons, I think it is, in 11 seasons, sorry, I think it is. You know, phenomenal, you know, starting with that Juan de Ramos side that did so well and almost won a league title. They weren't far away from a league title around about, was it 2008-09 or something like that, when it was a 3-horse race for the title. And I think they all went into the final day still able to win the title, but the advantage was with Real Madrid, and they unfortunately closed it out. But yeah, so many great teams, so many great players, and we've not been able to touch on them.
Sorry, just to interject quickly. No, I mean, that was actually, that was very relevant to mention that particular season. It was the 2007 year, and it was probably Sevilla's best ever team that had obviously been assembled.
Oh, they were wonderful to watch. I can remember watching that. Fred Canute, was he part of that side as well?
Freddie Canute and Luis.
And they were just wonderful to watch. And you know, the great thing for me with Spanish football is, as much as I love it, I don't side. I'm almost like I'm like Stu in that respect in Spanish football. I do not have a Spanish side that I follow. I just watch them, enjoy the teams. And there's loads of teams throughout Spanish football in history in my lifetime that I've loved watching. And that Sevilla side is way up there.
It is.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like I say, you know, we've brought you on to talk about your book. We've brought you on to talk about, you know, about the region, and you know, and I'm sure that, you know, people who are listening, hopefully, will be chomping at the bit to, you know, to go out buy the book. You know, the book is stunning. Obviously, by your knowledge, Colin is clearly exemplary on the subject. But I normally ask the last question. I take great pleasure in trying to find a difficult question, but trying to generate a questionable thing, but I think tonight I'm more than happy to hand over the reins of the last question to Gary. I think Gary's deserves it, and I think it's only right and just that Gary gets to ask the final question tonight.
Okay, well, thanks, Marty.
No, you're welcome.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to answer it with a statement as well. So first thing is, I've read the book, but Colin, I'm going to buy the book as well, because I think there's so much stuff in there that I'm going to use for research and in future articles I'm going to write. So I'm going to buy the book as well, and I recommend everybody else to do so if you want to understand Spanish football, particularly Sevilla football. So the question is this: which team, which club do you think are going to win La Liga next from Seville? Is it going to be Sevilla or Betis?
That's a very, very good question.
Brilliant, Gary. You've taken note of what we do here.
Thanks, Stu.
No worries.
I'm pulling your mate.
Obviously, I mentioned it earlier that usually the last question I get on these sort of discussion-themed questions about the book is which club do I prefer? And I can usually sit on the fence for that relative ease. But I think for this one, I'm going to have to go a little bit more definitive in the sense that we just spoke there about the Sevilla side of 2007, who won the Copa del Rey, who won the Europa League, or it's the UEFA Cup as it was then known. And I think had that team not have prioritised the cup competitions to the extent that they did, they would undoubtedly have won that league. And that was a league that included a Barcelona team who had Lionel Messi coming through, and they had the likes of Xavi, Andres Iniesta, and everyone else, and obviously Real Madrid. It was sort of, they still had that sort of Galacticos era and those fantastic names they had on that side. Yet Sevilla comprised, not on a shoestring budget, but on a budget that was completely incomparable to those two clubs, led by this sporting director, visionary Monchi, who obviously most people will now be quite familiar with. They challenged these sides over the course of a season, and they only collected 1 point from their final two matches, yet they only needed to win and draw from those games to lift the title. And I mean, that would have been an absolutely phenomenal achievement, because Deportivo and Valencia had both lifted titles in previous years, but this was different in the sense that Madrid and Barcelona at this particular point, they weren't vintage sides, but they were not at a low point in their history, and Sevilla just came so, so close. And it was almost like that was a once in a generation moment. And again, you kind of look, both clubs have only ever won one league title, neither has won it in the last, 60, 70 years. So to win a league title for either of these clubs is going to be a huge, huge achievement. It's going to need a lot of different issues coming together at once. One of the key things will be that Barcelona and Real Madrid will need to have poor seasons. Atletico Madrid will need to have a season that isn't vintage. Now, that's not impossible to think in the next 5 or 10 years, because football is very cyclical. I think Sevilla are in a better position than Betis, just because Sevilla have always been a very well-run club. Economically, they've always been a club who can make the most out of what the resources they have. They've been a launchpad for so many successful careers. But now I think they've started to prioritise a slightly different business model, as it were, was that they're now in a position, due to more equal TV rights and everything else and greater income from European competitions, that they can sign players for the here and now, that they can maybe sign players on a budget that is more inflated than what they have been used to dealing with. Whether or not that will work in terms of challenging for the top 1, 2, 3 positions in the league is yet to be seen, but I think they're in a position to do that. Betis, on the other hand, are a little bit further behind, but the fact is that Betis have the fourth biggest fan base in Spanish football outside of the established big three, and that's despite never having won anything. So imagine the potential that if this was a club who can properly get their act together, as it were, and become a club, and I think there's signs that this is happening, that they can be innovative off the field, that they can use things like social media particularly effectively to then build up a lot of different commercial relationships, which will in turn lead to income from their first team squad. And that's starting to happen. When you look at some of the signings that the Betis have made, like William Carvalho, like Nabil Fekir, I mean, players who are absolutely fantastic, certainly in terms of an international standard player. Yet, the thing with Betis, and it's been the case throughout their history, is just whenever you think they're building this great team, or just whenever you think things are about to go very, very well, they're cursed with this ability to shoot themselves in the foot. They usually either get relegated or suffer a tragic season after success, and they're never able to sustain a proper movement. Now, that's not to say that they never will, but if you're looking at it from a historical lens and you look at which club has always been the club that has been economically very smoothly run and it has an operation that is innovative, you always have to sort of side with Sevilla in that sense. So, yeah, it's a very interesting question. And again, I would have to say Sevilla in terms of the individuals involved with the club at the minute. But I think there are signs that these are two clubs who, whenever, say, Lionel Messi retires from playing, and we've already seen the effect of, say, Ronaldo leaving Madrid and there being a little bit of a period of flux. You know, football is cyclical. Those two clubs will not dominate Spanish football forever. And I think within the next 5 or 10 years, there could be an opportunity for a Sevilla, for a Betis, or even for a Valencia or Athletic Club to properly challenge for those top 1, 2, or 3 places in the league. So it's going to be very interesting to see if anyone can actually take advantage of that.
I love that answer. I love that answer. I always think Sevilla are a sort of a 7.5 out of 10 club, and Betis will sort of vary between being a 5 and a 9 out of 10 club. And it would be great to see Betis win the Liga, just because it would turn the whole system upside down, and it would their fan base is so widespread, as you mentioned earlier, that it'd just be magnificent for Spanish football.
Yeah, no, absolutely, and I think the final point to be made here is that when you think of these two clubs within the context of Spanish football, and you forget about Barcelona and Madrid and even Atleti, you've only really got Valencia, Athletic Club Bilbao, possibly Real Zaragoza. Obviously, they're not in the top division at the minute, but those are the clubs with the genuine reach and potential to launch these long-term sustained challenges for a league title, because Spanish football is not blessed with a lot of big clubs. It's blessed with a lot of clubs who are very well run, but in terms of a social reach, outside of a group of 7 or 8, there's really not many. So yeah, there's definitely the opportunity that if one of these clubs can properly explode, not obviously to be able to have done that in a European sense, but can you do it domestically, and can the conditions be there for them to do it? I think there's definitely a chance. It could take 5 years, 10 years, could take 20 years, but there's definitely going to be a chance, just like in 2007, that there's going to be an opening or an opportunity for a historic season.
Fantastic, mate.
Look, Colin, where do I start? You know, first of all, you know, the people who've listened, you know, we've barely scratched the surface. You know, if that makes sense of what's included in the book, the book is phenomenal. The detail is phenomenal. It's such an engaging story. Colin, thank you so much, so much for coming on and, you know, and talking to us.
Oh, no, it's been my absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me. Oh,
any time. And that's it. You know, it's a genuine any time. Any time at all, you just let us know. Gary, enjoyed it?
Oh, massively, mate. It's great to talk La Liga and Spanish football with a passionate guy like Colin. And as so massively knowledgeable guy as Colin as well. And Andalusian football and Seville football is a unique example of Spanish football as a microcosm. A joy, an absolute joy.
Brilliant. Stephen, again, as always, thank you very much for joining us.
It's always fascinating, and yeah, I'm going to say a joy as always. But that's been, you know, a wonderful way to spend an hour or so.
Brilliant. All that's left for me is to say thank you to the listeners, and please join us again next time on the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.